If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast, brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Matt Elton. We have another in our Everything You Want to Know series, in which we ask you to pose the questions to a leading expert in a particular topic. Today we're exploring medieval daily life in England, and our expert is Professor Chris Dyer. Chris is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Leicester and a leading expert in medieval economic and social history. His books include Everyday Life in Medieval England and Making a Living in the Middle Ages. Putting the questions is our content director, David Musgrove.
Thank you very much for joining us. How are you today?
Fine, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's jump in with the first question, which is from Frank Ikaza, who asks, what was a typical day for the average person? So a big question to start with, and I don't know how easy that is to answer.
I suppose the first thing to say is that many of us live a very routine life in modern times. You know, we're doing the same thing roughly every day. We go, when there isn't a virus around, we go to work, we start at 9, we finish at 5, we go back home. It's not like that in the Middle Ages. There's a constant change with the seasons from through the year. Most people are involved in farming. Most people are in agriculture. And of course, that means the farming year goes through a tremendous cycle of ploughing and sowing and harvesting and all the rest of it through the year. So really, there isn't a typical day. But I suppose I ought to say that, you know, there are a sort of a fair number of working days, but there are also a lot of days when work does not happen. So I think it's best to think of them having about 240 working days through the year. And essentially, most people are working in agriculture and most people are working on their own land. You know, the lord of the manor had this right to demand that they worked on his land, and a minority of them did have to do that, and that took up a good deal of their time. But for most people and for most of their time, they're doing their own work on their own holding, doing the routines of farming and cultivation.
So I was going to say, so how far are they dictated, is the day dictated by the availability of natural light? Presumably that is a big player there.
Yes, indeed, yes, because they can't turn the light on. I mean, their light is a tallow candle, which doesn't give very much light, and they're rather expensive if they're used in quantity. So they do have, as you say, they are very dependent on the natural light. And of course, in midwinter, they've only got about, 8 hours of daylight, and the rest of the time is in darkness. So that is a limitation. Of course, the other thing which limits them is weather. I mean, you know, that there are days go by when they simply cannot do any work, and which of course affects modern farmers too, but it affects them much more. They're, you know, extreme frost or very heavy rain and so on, and they just can't do any work at all.
So, but they would have been, you know, very aware of the seasons, presumably, as you talked about, and activity would have changed through the year. And we can see that in medieval calendars and things, can't we? That depict the various different agricultural activities that happen through the year.
Yes. And the great thing is the cycle of grain growing, because after all, they are very much dependent on corn. That is their wheat, barley, oats. These are the things they live on. And so, you have a large part of the darker part of the year is ploughing and planting. You plant the wheat in October. You plant the barley in March and April. You know, you have these set times for these tasks, and then you wait for the grain to grow, and you weed it, and then you harvest it, which is for them a very long process. You know, we harvesting for us is done in a day or two. You know, big machine churns through the fields taking it in. They're laboring away with many workers over many, many weeks. I mean, the harvest goes on for about 2 months of the year. It takes up almost the whole of July and August and part of September as well. So there's a huge amount of time in the summer spent just gathering in crops.
An ancillary question here that a couple of people wanted to know about. Beverly Waite and Dee Withers on Twitter are asking about sleep, essentially, about the concept of medieval sleep. And there's been a little bit of talk about that people used to get up in the middle of the night and do things and then go back to sleep again. Mm. What do we know about medieval sleeping patterns?
I think the idea of getting up in the middle of the night is probably based on the monastic day. You know, because the monks get up in the dark, because they have this very complicated and demanding cycle of prayer that they have to go for. So they're going off and going into the monastic church and doing their prayers. I don't think ordinary people got up in the middle of the night, but there's a certain amount of night work. For example, if you're a shepherd, you have to stay awake at night during the lambing season. And a shepherd who didn't do that got criticised. In towns, there's a thing called the watch. You know, they're very worried about law and order. So through the night, there is a group of men who are delegated to wander through the streets looking for trouble, you know, telling people to go to bed, get off the street, behave themselves and so on. So there is a sort of nightlife of that kind in towns, as well as the sort of necessities of working at night in the countryside. But people in towns are very worried about people working in the dark. The authorities are worried that if a weaver or a shoemaker goes on working in the dark, he'll make mistakes. And the town will get a terrible reputation because it's selling wonky shoes or badly woven cloth. So they say you've got to stop working when it's dark. You know, there's and of course in towns they have clocks. Unlike in the countryside, they have clocks, so they can say you've got to stop work at 6 o'clock or whatever the time is. So they're a bit like us in that respect. They are ruled by mechanical time.
And bells, of course, the ringing of bells, I think, would have been quite a big feature of town life, wouldn't it?
Yes. Well, of course, that's how they know. I mean, after all, many clocks have no face. All that the bell has is a signal to the man with the rope to pull it to sound the bell. So the bell is not actually mechanically driven. But yes, their lives are punctuated by the sounds of these bells.
Thinking about urban life just very quickly, presumably that would have been less impacted by the sort of the seasonal round than rural life, or not so much?
Well, I mean, there's still this problem of light. And there's also demand for the things they're making. I mean, I'm thinking of towns as being centres of a lot of craftsmen, you know, working away, making shoes or cloth or whatever. And demand for those things will vary through the year. So there'll be a sudden rush of demand for shoes and boots and so on in the autumn. So October will be a very busy month for shoemakers. And of course, there are lulls in trade when things go wrong on the the ships crossing the North Sea don't sail or whatever, and so there's a reduced demand for some of the things they're making. So they are very variable as well. There is a seasonal element in town life as well as in the country.
And just thinking of the bigger picture of the topic we're talking about here. So our preface was medieval daily life. Medieval obviously covers a lot of time. During the course of the medieval period from the 11th through to the 15th century, is there a move of people from countryside to towns? Do we see that happening in this period, or are people sort of staying broadly where they are?
Well, at the beginning of the period, the 11th century, about 1 in 10 of the population lives in towns. So it's really quite a minority. By 1300, so that's halfway through the period, it's 1 in 5. And that proportion remains right through for the rest of the period. So 20% of English people, and indeed 20% of most people on the continent as well, are town dwellers. So that leaves 80% in the countryside.
Thank you. Right, let's move on to the next question, which is a very popular internet search term, which is, how did life for men and women differ during the period? Which again is a big question, and I'm sure there's a lot you could say about it. But what are the main points that you would bring up there?
Well, I think the popular view, the popular assumption, is that women have a very miserable, downtrodden time. You know, that they are subordinate to men. They have no public role. Remember, well, the Queen of England has a public role, but in normal towns and villages, they're not allowed to be mayors or to serve on a jury or hold any of the offices or administrative positions that there are around. So they're very much governed by men. So there's that sense of their being deprived of a public face, and of course they are ruled by their husbands, you know, they're subject to the discipline of the household and so on. So you can paint a picture of women's lives being very oppressed and very subordinate to men and those in authority. I mean, all of that's true, if you like, but there are some sort of redeeming features. Women's lives aren't entirely downtrodden and miserable. It's very interesting to see that when a husband dies, and remember, people do die in the Middle Ages in their 30s and 40s and 50s, so it's, being a widow is a very common experience. Many women will have 2 or 3 husbands. You know, it's not because of divorce as now. Divorce is really almost impossible. They're divorced by death, you know. But the widow, it's interesting to see that although she's in theory not playing any part in the husband's business, when the husband dies, you find she takes it up. You know, that a weaver's wife will suddenly become a weaver. And you realise that all along, she's been, let's take a shoemaker as an example. When a shoemaker dies, the widow takes over as shoemaker. And it's easy to see what's happening, but they are partners in effect. You know, the man will be, when they're both married and alive, the man will be working in the back of the shop, visible from the street. Everyone wants to see what's being made and how carefully it's being made. But the woman will be in the front selling the shoes. So there will be a strong common interest on the part of husband and wife in the work they're doing. And it means that when the husband dies, you know, she can take over. She'll hire a servant or an apprentice or something to do the work, to make the shoes. But she, you know, essentially, she's in charge. So women are, in some senses, partners of their husbands as well as being subordinate to them. And yes, it's women, and women do have a sort of public life. If you're looking at the village, for example, although their principal job is to be domestic, to look after the household, cook meals, do the washing, all that stuff. and they're also in charge of the garden and the animals and birds in the garden. They who feed the poultry, they feed the pigs, you know. They do the gardening. They're the ones who grow the cabbages and so on. So there's a lot of work in what you might call the woman's sphere in the household and around the house. But she gets out, you know. She goes to the mill to have her corn ground. She goes to the stream or the pond to fill a bucket with water, because most people don't have wells. They have to bring the water from outside. She goes to the common oven to get her bread baked. And on all of those occasions, of course, she has opportunities for social interaction. And you get the impression that there's a lot of talk, dare I say it, gossip, at the at the stream or in the mill or wherever that she might meet up with her chums. So there is, you know, she has a public dimension to her life. She's not entirely confined to the home. And one last thing is that I said she's in charge of the garden and the poultry, and she will do the dairying as well. She will milk the cows and make the cheese. So when when it's market day in the nearby town, the peasant woman will go there with a basket, with cheese, with eggs, with vegetables, and will sell them in the street or in the market. So you know, again, and she has an opportunity to go outside the house. And I've always suspected that if she does that work, if she does that marketing, she's allowed to keep the money. I couldn't prove that, but I suspect that she will have a considerable say anyway in how that money is spent, because she's earned it herself. So there is a sort of little bit of economic independence, if you like, in women's daily lives.
A linked question, perhaps, or one that leads on from it, is our next one from Ado Mohammed, who asks, how rigid was the class system? Did it even exist as we imagine it today? And basically asking about mobility, social mobility, whether that was a thing that was possible.
Again, I think probably people have a conception, which is partly true, of a rather rigid, compartmentalized society in which people have defined roles and where they have very strong formal commitments and where their actions are very limited. I mean, the obvious thing to land on is serfs. About 40% of the English population in the middle of the Middle Ages, in the 13th century, were serfs, so they're unfree. And it's very easy to represent them as being a very oppressed, very limited, very controlled group who have to work for their lord and have limitations on their freedom of marriage, for example. At the same time, the people at the top of society, the aristocracy, are also defined, if you like, by law. They have rules and they have conventions, which means that you know immediately who an aristocrat is. They are a well-defined group, and they have a particular roles in society, in government, and in war, and so on. But if you begin to chip away at these legends, if you like, about the rigidity of medieval society, you find it's not quite as rigid and controlled as you might think. Take that business about controlling marriage, for example. The rule is that a servile woman cannot marry without the lord's license. So in other words, you might think he chooses who she marries. In fact, what happens is that she goes to the manorial court, and it is the woman who often does this. A young woman, say in her early 20s, will go to the court and she will offer a sum of money for the license. And the lord is very happy with that, because what he wants is the money. So he not really wants to control her marriage. He wants to get her revenue. So she gives him 2 shillings or 3 shillings or 4 shillings or whatever the going rate is. And he gives her permission to marry wherever, whoever she likes. So off she goes and marries the chap she's met in the next village, and all are happy. So you know, the point is that there are these dreadfully constraining rules and regulations and demands, but when you probe into them, you find that there are ways out of them, and people are not quite as constrained as you might think. As far as mobility is concerned, how does a serf or a peasant, I mean, someone just living on a few acres of land, and how can they improve themselves? Well, one route, which is only taken by a small minority, but it's still an important one, is to become a clergyman. And what you find is that peasant men will go to their lord and seek permission for their son to go to school. There are schools in almost all the small towns will have a school, so the schools are accessible. They cost money, of course, so it's only the better off people who can afford to send their sons to school. And of course, as well as having to pay for their school fees, they're also losing their labour, because boys work, you know. So a peasant with, say, 30 acres of land, who is relatively well off, will be able to afford to do that. And the son will take the exams. He'll become fluent in Latin, which is the qualification, and he can be ordained as a clergyman. And that can be a very good job. And there are examples of peasant sons who became bishops. You know, you in theory, you could rise up into the very top of the church. So for a small minority, there was that avenue of mobility. But for most people, the main ways out of their village or out of the relative poverty in which they live is migration. So you get people moving to you mentioned moving to the town, which can transform their lives, move to another village where opportunities are better. And the other thing they can do is to, if they're skilled at selling their produce, if they're able to make a bit of money from extra activities like working in a craft or something, they can accumulate a bit of money and acquire more land. And so, you know, you find someone with only 20 acres of land can buy another 20 acres of land and therefore become considerably better off. And just occasionally, you can show that a peasant can actually join the aristocracy. You know, the bottom of the aristocracy is not entirely sealed off. And you can spot them because they've got very ordinary names. You know, you find someone called Smith becoming a gentleman. You know, well, obviously, if your name's Smith, it means that your father or your grandfather was just an artisan. So it is possible by luck, judgment, and skill to acquire more and more wealth and to pass yourself off as being suitable for inclusion in the aristocracy. So, you know, if you want the best example of that, of course, the most famous example, which I'm sure many people know, was the Spencer family, who were sheep farmers on a fairly small scale in the middle of Warwickshire in the 14 sort of 50s, who acquired more and more land and more sheep. And eventually, in the early 16th century, they became lords of the manor of a place called Althorpe in Northamptonshire. And they ended up, they almost ended up as Queen of England. They ended up as Earl. They became Earls anyway, and really did join the big time aristocracy. So, you know, there are stories of individual families who could rise, but it is a very tiny number. You can't find that many members of the highest aristocracy who come from peasant origins.
And again, following that, then Samuel Gibson asks about how varied job prospects were and whether people went into the trade sort of dictated by what was around them. So I suppose you know, the shoemaker example. If your father was a shoemaker, were you inevitably going to be a shoemaker?
Yes. I mean, that did tend to happen. After all, it happens now. I mean, fathers will have expectations that their sons will succeed them. And of course, the key to all this is training. You know, after all, a peasant trains his son on how to be a farmer, you know, how to shear sheep and how to plough a field and all the other skills that you need to be to do agriculture. But in the towns, fathers will train their sons in the appropriate skill. But it's very interesting to see that it's really another side to social mobility, the way in which individuals could make different choices. And you get there's some very interesting figures from the city of York, because if you were a qualified craftsman, you would become a freeman of the city. And we have these long lists of freemen who are being brought into the town. And to qualify as one way of qualifying as a freeman was if your father was a freeman. So there are very good records of this succession of a son into his father's trade. But quite a lot didn't progress into their father's trade. And if you were a baker, among the York bakers, about a half were succeeded by their sons. Or shall we say, half of bakers' sons themselves became bakers. Well, bakers were a fairly steady trade, you know. Everyone wants to eat bread. It's quite a good living. So one can see that the sons were making a fairly good choice, but they didn't all want to spend their lives kneading dough and, you know, heating up ovens and so on. It was not always a comfortable job. Carpenters. Being a carpenter was not a very good job. It was not very well paid. It had a low status, and it involved a lot of hard work, sort of heaving, you know, great beams of wood around. And only a quarter of carpenters' sons succeeded their father. So one in four became carpenters. The others got other jobs. At the other extreme, York had a number of wealthy goldsmiths. Goldsmiths, of course, made a good living. The work wasn't very hard. There were all sorts of opportunities to make money on the side. It was a good profession. And then you find three quarters of the sons of goldsmiths became goldsmiths. You know, they could see where their bread was buttered, and they followed their fathers into what was a good trade. So you know, it depends on the trade and depends on the choices being made. But people could move jobs, and well, after all, it's all also part of this business of migrating from one place to another. If I could just give you one example. There's a village in Worcestershire, North Worcestershire, called Ombersley. And there's a very nice case of a lad from Ombersley at the age of 16 who moved to Coventry, which is a journey of about 30 miles. It's quite a long way. His father was a peasant, so if he'd stayed at home, he would have ended up as a peasant, I suppose, or working on the land anyway. But what he did was to become a servant to a baker in the centre of Coventry, a very high-powered, wealthy baker who was selling bread to the richest people in Coventry from a shop in the centre of the city. And this lad became his servant and presumably learnt how to become a baker, and we don't actually know whether he did become a baker, but he was well set to end up as a prosperous baker in Coventry, which would have been probably a lot better than being a peasant in Ombersley. So, yeah, that's the sort of example one can give, showing that, yeah, enterprising, fortunate individuals could move on.
So you've expressed a higher degree of social mobility than perhaps people might imagine. Just thinking about physical mobility just a little bit, you just talked about there, but that ties into a couple of questions that we had about peasants moving around. So Annika of Vrienne, for instance, wanted to know how couples met and if most marriages were arranged or for practical reasons. And Dee Withers wanted to know about the fact that peasants being tied to the land and not being allowed to leave without the Lord's say-so, as you talked about earlier, and with villages being small, he wanted to know whether there was a lot of inbreeding and whether people were marrying too close together. So what can you say about that?
Well, to take the last point first, you couldn't marry your relatives, you couldn't marry your cousins and so on, because the church prohibited it. And the church was quite strict about that. So you had to find a marriage partner who wasn't a relative. And that obviously drove you to find a marriage partner outside the village. And the rest, someone's worked out the statistics again in Hampshire, 50% of marriages were between people from different villages. So you have 50% of them married people from their own village and 50% married outside. So there was quite a lot of movement of that kind out of the village. And you can see how they might have met. There are all sorts of social occasions, celebrations on May Day were always associated with couples meeting each other and creeping off into the fields to enjoy each other's company. You know, this is the sort of thing that happened in villages, and people would move from one village to another for these celebrations, and so there would be these social occasions. Actually, a very important way in which people met their marriage partners was through being servants. What happens is that it is very common, for both in town and in country, for teenagers around about the age of 13, 14, say, to be taken on as servants in somebody else's household. An Italian visitor to England said the English were cruel and didn't like their children and sent them off to live in the houses of strangers. So there is this strong custom of people going off to another household, serving them, being given their food and accommodation and perhaps a small amount of money, but taking advantage of what they could learn. I mean, if it was nothing, if they were peasants, they learned how to plough and so on. If they were peasant girls, they learned how to brew and make cheese and do all the domestic skills. And of course, if you went into the household of a shoemaker or a weaver or a smith or something, you learnt that trade. And these were often the occasions when couples met. Obviously, the cleverest thing to do was to marry the boss's daughter, you know. So the servant would mingle with the children of the household and grow up with them and form attachments in that way, or one servant would form a relationship with another servant. So this is a great mix, great social and geographical mixing process by which people move in their teens and early 20s into the houses of other people, and often in another village or in the town, and so they acquire a knowledge of another place, and they acquire a knowledge of people from those places. So that's one way in which that happens. But I'm painting too rosy a picture. I'm implying that people freely chose their own marriage partners without any pressure. And I mean, there would be a good deal of pressure from parents against what they would regard as unsuitable marriages, no doubt about that. But there is no compulsory marriage. I think for young people, I should say, there is no compulsory marriage. I mean, it's very hard to find examples of punishment of children who don't marry the right people and so on. There's a what the parents want, I think, is to be able to have a considerable choice in who their children marry, but they also want their children to make a choice as well. They want them to be happy. So there is a sort of compromise going on between the parents' wishes and the children's wishes. I said young people. I think widows sometimes have a very hard time of it. When a woman loses her husband, particularly if she has a holding of land in the countryside, people are worried in the village that she's not able to cope with all the work of the holding, with all the women on the whole didn't plough, there were a whole number of tasks which were best done by men in their view. The lord of the manor didn't like it because he was worried that if she made a hash of the running the holding, she wouldn't be able to pay her rent. So he was worried about that. So there's a lot of, pressure on widows to marry, to remarry. And to our mind, there's a rather shockingly short time between a woman being widowed and marrying somebody else. 3 months is not unusual, certainly 6 months. They do marry very quickly, and you feel that their choice is not very wide. After all, they've got to find a man who isn't married already. And a lot of older men will be obviously married to somebody else, and they don't have a lot of choice. And I suspect they're sometimes marrying out of duty rather than any other consideration. Can I just make one last point about marriage and about the age of marriage? Set aside the widows, just focusing on younger people. They tend to marry in their very late teens or early 20s, probably mostly early 20s. They're marrying other young people. In other words, they're marrying people of about the same age. There is a parity of age, in which is very different from the situation you find, say, in Italy at this time, where it's very common for very young girls to marry what we would think of as old men. Men in their 40s and 50s will be marrying 18-year-olds or even younger. And that doesn't happen in England. The young people, on the whole, marry young people. And that makes a big difference to the relationship within the household. They are companions. They like each other. They work together. That partnership that I talked about earlier between when the husband dies, which is exposed when the husband dies, that partnership between husband and wife is something which is born out of that closeness of age, which gives them more in common than would be the case elsewhere.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We know, after all, how they wipe their bums. Do you want to hear this?
Let's do that.
They used leaves. They didn't have toilet paper. They used leaves. And I know this because there's a corny medieval joke, which was, what is the cleanest leaf in the forest? And the answer is the holly tree.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Right. Let's go. Well, actually, you just mentioned then in your last answer the importance of events like May Day for development of conjugal rights, and you talked earlier about the number of days that people worked, and it wasn't people weren't working every day. So that leads us to a couple of questions from Rachel Ferguson and Todd Patton about what did ordinary medieval people do for fun and recreation, and what were the annual celebrations and holiday days and feast days that people commemorated?
Right. Yes. There's a danger. I always feel the great danger in talking about this of giving a false impression, because, people in the 19th century used to sort of idealize medieval life. And this led to an accusation that people believed in Merry England. And there is a lot of evidence of holidays, celebrations, games, fun. I'll tell you about that, because that's what the question is. And you've got to appreciate the quite large time, amount of free time they have. They don't have the sort of long, sort of week-long or fortnight-long holidays that we have, except, of course, at Christmas. The Christmas is a time when there's a consecutive 12 days of celebrations. At a time of year, of course, when very often you can't do anything else because it's dark and the weather's bad. But through the rest of the year, there's about 40 compulsory holidays, 40 saints' days, St. Peter and St. Paul and St. John the Baptist and, all of the different saints, the Annunciation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, they all have these days which are set aside as holidays when people are not supposed to work. And as well as those religious holidays, there are secular holidays as well. There's May Day, you've mentioned. There are the Summer Games, which often actually they do coincide sometimes with with Whitsun. So it is a religious holiday as well. So there are many occasions when people do not work and when they find non-working activities. And there's a lot of references to games and sports. Mainly that, of course, we know about them because they were prohibited. But the fact they were being prohibited shows they actually took place. So there's a lot of football played by teams of indeterminate size without rules and with a lot of violence. People got killed playing football quite regularly. It was a dangerous sport. Handball of various kinds. Tennis, as you find, quoits. There are a lot of outdoor games, and there's a lot that goes indoors as well. Cards, dice, various board games. Nine Men's Morris is a very common board game. These are the sort of things that they do indoors, by candlelight, I suppose. You can paint this picture of a lot of fun, a lot of activities, and there's a sort of you get these sort of fundraising events organised by the church wardens, the church ales, when it is almost compulsory for people to drink ale, paying for it, of course, which will go to church funds. It's a sort of drunken church fete, you might say, and then you have the celebrations of the summer games, for example, often involve what we would call drama or pageants, where people dress up as Robin Hood the Robin Hood game is played, or the Robin Hood play is enacted. So there's a lot of what we would say cultural activity going on, dancing and all the rest of it. So, I'm going to stop because I'll go on cataloguing all these fun occasions. You've got to remember, most people really can't afford these things. I mean, you know, you can't drink a lot of ale for fun if you don't have the money. A lot of people drank water rather than ale, they don't have the time. The church complains that they actually work during their holidays. They don't observe the holidays that the church is trying to enforce. So, you know, it is there's a darker side to all this of people perhaps taking holidays when they can't really afford them, and when the amount of fun that can be had is distinctly limited. So I'll end on that depressing note.
And moving on from there, you mentioned things that were prohibited, things that people shouldn't have been doing. That leads on very nicely to our next question from Dee Withers again. He's one of our most prolific questioners. So thank you, Dee Withers, for your questions. Who asks about the police force and says, you know, with no police force and people living as we talked about on fairly low incomes, why was there not, constant anarchy, and how was law kept with no one to keep order?
Well, everybody was their own policeman. That's the answer. I mean, we have police constables who are employed out of our taxes in rather small numbers, so they're not very good at maintaining the law and order at the moment. But every village had a constable, a part-time volunteer. Well, he wasn't actually a volunteer. He was pushed into the job. It wasn't a very popular one. But anyway, they did have a constable whose job was to maintain some sort of order. But most important is that, I mean, every household has a discipline within it. You know, the law was that every householder had the main past of his household. That means he had legal responsibility for every member of the household. So if a child or a servant or a wife committed some crime, then the head of the household would be held to be at least partly responsible. And every household belonged to a self-policing organization, the tithing. So once or twice a year, there would be a gathering of all the villagers. The technical term is the viewer frank pledge. And every tithing, that is a group of legally responsible people, appoints a tithing man. And the tithing man steps forward and tells the court of the crimes that have been committed. He will talk about petty thefts. He'll talk about violent attacks. He will talk about the daily routine of minor offences that goes on in the village, and the people who have committed these offences will be judged by a jury, and they will be made to pay a sum of money. They pay to have the mercy of the Lord, because the Lord of the man, of course, is presiding over all this. They pay to have the mercy of the Lord, and that means paying tuppence or threepence or fourpence to the Lord of the man for their crime, if you like. So there's a very, very strong self-policing system which maintains a good deal of order, though there is quite a lot of theft and violence as well, but it's kept within limits by this self-discipline.
Now, we've got loads of questions which we're going to conflate into one, because they basically all boil down to the same sort of topic about hygiene and washing. So we had questions about whether people smelt and whether everyone else was inured to everyone else's body odour. We got questions about how they cut their nails and their hair, and particularly about dentistry and how bad teeth were and whether people were able to keep their teeth clean. So I suppose that all boils down to one basic question is were people clean? Were they able to wash themselves in the Middle Ages, and how did they go about that?
Well, I wish I could give you sort of precise evidence of this, and of course, because things like washing and so on are cutting your nails are sort of such minor routines of daily life. They didn't write very much about it. Come to think of it, we don't write much about it either, but except when there's an epidemic, and then we're all taught to wash our hands all the time. But that's unusual. So yes, people, I'm sure, did wash. Let me give you some evidence. If you look at the inventory of the possessions of peasants and artisans in towns, of craftsmen in towns, you get a list of furnishings, you know, tables and chairs and so on. But one item that constantly recurs, or two items that constantly recurs, is a basin and a ewer. And a basin was, well, a wash basin, and the ewer was a jug of water. And it's often also linked with a towel. And what clearly happens is that before a meal, there is a sort of little ceremony, I think, of people washing their hands in the basin and drying them with a towel. People often ask me, did they wash after the meal? And I think they must have, because they didn't have forks, so they used their hands a lot in eating. So I suspect they also probably washed afterwards. But there was this, if you like, almost a ritual of washing. Because what the questioners want to know is whether there was a sort of private washing, you know, did they wash their armpits and so on in the privacy of their chamber or whatever? And I can't imagine that they didn't. I mean, another piece of evidence is washing of clothes. A lot of evidence of clothes were washed. People are always complaining, in fact, that their drinking water is being polluted because their neighbours are washing doing their laundry in the stream that runs through the village. You know. It's a piece of negative evidence, if you like. But if they're washing their clothes, then it must be part of their routine. So what's the point of washing your shirt if you then don't wash your skin as well? I think there must be washing of people as well as washing of their clothes. So I would go for washing on the whole. Though I'm sure they didn't have much hot water. Hot water was in short supply. Water was actually in short supply as well, because, of course, very few people had their own supply of water. They were bringing it in buckets and so on from outside. So water was in short supply, and they didn't use it as much as we do, and I'm sure they didn't use hot water very much. But they that doesn't stop you washing. Teeth. Well, actually, I could be wonderfully statistically precise about teeth, because, after all, we've dug up hundreds and hundreds of medieval people, modern people as well, and in their skulls there are the teeth, and you can count how many of the teeth are rotten, how many of the teeth have got holes in, how many have got caries. And the answer is that in the Middle Ages they had less than we do. The figure for Warham, the best excavated and the largest and the most thoroughly studied village cemetery in England is at Warham Percy in Yorkshire. And there, 10% of the teeth were, you know, defective in some way. In fact, that probably is rather a high figure, because the cemetery continued in use after 1500. If you go to cemeteries which were earlier in date, which finished earlier, then you find the figure goes down to something like 6%. So really, that's it's miserable to have even one tooth rotting and hurting, but it's better to have one than 20. So yes, the rate of rot in their teeth is quite low. And if you compare that with 19th century evidence, then the figure is 25% or even higher. So people's teeth were healthier in the 14th century than they were in the 19th century. And the authority, I'm not a great authority on teeth, but the authorities I read about this always mention one factor as being crucial: sugar. They didn't have sugar. And well, they rich people had sugar in small quantities in the Middle Ages, imported from the Mediterranean, but poor people, ordinary people, did not have sugar. So, and of course, in the 19th century, everybody sweetened their tea in, you know, very heavily. And so there's a lot of sugar about and that rots the teeth.
Do we have any, with that lack of sugar, did they actually need to clean their teeth? Do we have any evidence for how they might have done it?
I'm sorry you've harried me on this point because I have no evidence. I have no evidence on teeth. I have seen references in literature to people having yellow teeth, which disapprovingly. So it obviously there's obviously some way in which they whiten their teeth, and I can imagine, say, for having a twig that you sort of fray the end of. I've heard this happening in the 19th century. Hit the end of a twig with a hammer or something, and it breaks down into bristles, in effect, and you can brush your teeth that way. We know, after all, how they wipe their bums. Do you want to hear this?
Let's do that.
They used leaves. They didn't have toilet paper. They used leaves. And I know this because there's a corny medieval joke, which was, what is the cleanest leaf in the forest? And the answer is the holly tree. You can understand the logic of that.
Excellent. Right. Let's move on from hygiene and cleanliness. We've got a couple more good questions. We've got one from Kerry Burns here, who asks about the language barriers, if any, between the common folk and the nobility, and talks about whether people were speaking sort of Old English versus Norman French and Latin, as we talked about the church language. So basically asking who said what to who and what languages were being spoken.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there is a language gap, if you like, in after the Norman conquest. You know, after 1066, you have an aristocracy, many of whom are of Norman or French, Northern French origin, whose language is French. The English carry on speaking English. They actually carry on writing in English. There's a lot of evidence in the 12th century, you know, quite a long time after 1066, when people are still, educated, intelligent people are writing writing things in the English language. So the English language continues as a literary language. French is the language that the aristocracy speak to each other, but there's a lot of evidence that the aristocracy began to think of themselves as English quite early on. You know, in the sort of late 12th century, the people of rank, the knights and so on, do begin to think of themselves as English, and that is greatly expanded, encouraged after 1204, when the French conquered Normandy. So the aristocracy in England had to choose between being English or Norman. And the ones who chose to be English obviously had a much a stronger commitment to living in England and identifying with England. It's pretty clear that they are, if you like, bilingual. They speak French to each other, but they do know English. And that continues. I mean, in the 14th century even, when England's at war with France, you still have a French-speaking aristocracy, but who are becoming even more English in their culture and so on, and French, you know, becomes less commonly spoken. But the question is, how do people speak to each other? And I suspect that most aristocrats had learnt quite a bit of English by the 12th century, so that there wasn't really a big language barrier. And of course, the people who actually spoke to the ordinary people, the people who actually communicated with the peasants, were sort of lower officials, you know, reeves and so on, bailiffs, people like that, who probably would know both languages and could translate. So I think the barrier wasn't that great. The church, of course, spoke Latin throughout, or at least they used Latin for their services. But once the so people were, after all, it was until, was it 1970 when the Catholic Church abandoned Latin services? I mean, it's continued into the 20th century. So it's you know, Catholics, everybody in England, of course, was a Catholic. The Catholics were used to religious services in Latin. They accepted that. They learnt roughly what was going on, I suppose. But the sermon would be in English. And when the clergyman spoke to them, it would be in English. So it wasn't a barrier to communication between the clergy and the laity.
So that idea of the peasantry going to church and sort of scratching their head and not really knowing what's going on because everyone speaking Latin isn't quite true.
Well, they don't know the details. They don't know what each word means. But they would have a fair idea of the drift of what was being said and the essential meaning of it. They had quite a high level of religious understanding. It's just that they didn't know the words, you know. And of course, they didn't know the Bible. The Bible wasn't translated into English. It was translated unofficially into English at the end of the 14th century. It wasn't properly translated become generally available until the 16th century. So they relied for their knowledge of the Bible on, you know, the pictures on church walls or stained glass windows or the sermons that they heard. But they were familiar with, you know, all the main stories. They knew, you know, they knew about who the apostles were and all that. They had quite a higher level of religious knowledge than most of us do, on the basis of oral transmission, if you like.
Right, last question, and a good one to finish on, from Josephine Wong, who wants to know, how did people in the medieval period think about ageing and whether there was any concept of retirement?
Yes, of course, their idea of age is different from ours because so many people were dead by the age of 60. So, you know, you were becoming elderly earlier than we do. The problem, of course, is whether they respect the elderly or do they resent them. On the whole, there is probably quite a high level of respect. When there's some dispute about tithes or property rights or inheritance or something, the authorities will consult people, elderly people who will have a strong memory of what happened in the past. And you get the impression that people in their 60s and 70s were given an authority. They were respected. They had useful knowledge and so on. Whereas I think there's a tendency now to think that the elderly have run out of ideas, but no, in the Middle Ages their opinions are valued. Retirement, that's interesting. On the whole, if you're very poor, if you're just a labourer without any land, you just carry on working as long as you possibly can. And when you run out of puff and can't actually do heavy manual work, you can do lighter work like spinning, for example. You know, for spinning on the whole was a woman's job, but you find old men were doing it as well because it was something they could do sitting down, and it wasn't physically taxing. So there were bits of work that you could carry on doing, and there's no pension, so you have to find your own living. But and of course you hope for support from your family, but if you had any land. There's a very well-trodden route to retirement. What you did was when you were getting tired of ploughing all the time and doing all the chores of farming, you said to your son or to some younger person who wasn't necessarily a relative, I will give you my land if you promise to provide me with a living. So I suppose we would call it you're retiring before you've died. So you're giving them the advantage of acquiring land of a still living person. And the rules will be quite strict. You know, they will set out exactly what the son or the new tenant has got to provide for the old couple or the old man or the old woman. You know, the accommodation in the house, a particular room, or a separate cottage, perhaps, in the garden, you know, and a certain amount of corn and a certain amount of food of a better quality. You know, I've seen one where the old boy was promised a quarter of beef, that is a quarter of a cow, salted in a barrel, that would be to last him through the year. So they're given all these promises of food, drink, and clothing, which will keep them going. So in effect, they're surrendering their property, their land, in exchange for a guarantee of a continued living, and you know, which only expires with death. So they do retire, and they have a sort of pension.
Well, thank you, Chris. That's you've opened up quite a few ideas there that I think probably many of our listeners won't be aware of, about these ideas of social mobility and physical mobility, and the fact that people could, in a way, retire is an interesting point, isn't it? So I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed that. The book that you wrote a while ago, Everyday Life in Medieval England, does cover a lot of these things. Is that still an accurate sort of guide to the period? I mean, it's
of course it is. No, it's in fact it's a book about it's a book of essays. In fact, it sort of picks out particular things and highlights certain rather specialised things. If you wanted an overview which still emphasises everyday life, then you ought to look at my book called Making a Living. Making a Living in the Middle Ages is a much more comprehensive, more up to date and comprehensive, that's right, view of daily life in the Middle Ages.
Well, Chris, Professor Chris Dyer, thank you very much for that fascinating expert guide into medieval daily life.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
If you want to know more about medieval daily life, there's a series of video talks from our Medieval Life and Death Week available at our website at historyextra.com.